The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. The government of Scotland has unveiled a new set of standards for medication-assisted treatment. They form a key part of the government's response to Scotland's drug-related deaths public health emergency. They also represent the basis for a transformational change of the experiences of people engaged with medication-assisted treatment services in Scotland. The Scottish Drugs Forum recently held a webinar to introduce and explain these standards. We're going to hear from some of the presenters on today's show. First, here are Dr. Duncan McCormick, chair of the Drug Death Task Force MAT subgroup, and Eleanor Dickey, the organizational lead for Public Health Scotland.
I'm Eleanor Dickey, based at Public Health Scotland, and I'm the MAT program lead in the drugs team there. It's great to be here with you today.
I'm Duncan McCormick. I'm a public health consultant at NHS Lothian, and I'm working closely with Eleanor and the rest of the team. I also chair the MAT subgroup of the Drug Death Task Force.
So we're going to run through some slides just outlining the evidence and the standards. And it's really just to bring the work to you to demonstrate the progress so far and really just reflect that this work has been protected as a priority both by the Scottish Government and the Drug Death Task Force, as well as Public Health Scotland. And the phase of the work now is really just to ensure that they can be the best they can be with your input. We've heard that we've got low levels of numbers in treatment. If we move on to the next slide, the nature of the standards is really to bring some improvement and innovation. And we wanted to open and close with this image just to demonstrate the importance that innovation happens in many ways and not to underestimate the small steps. We don't want this work to be out of reach for anybody, anybody concerned in services, anybody delivering services, or anybody experiencing services. And so we just felt it was important to reflect on what the offer is today. We hope that those of you that are way ahead of us will see the standards as a framework to continue to develop your services. And those of you that have seen opportunities for improvement, we hope this will give you the confidence and the permission. We move to the next slide. The definition of medication-assisted treatment is the use of medications such as opioids, together with the psychological and social supports in the treatment and care of individuals who experience problems with their drug use. And that's really to reflect the holistic nature of a rights-based approach, ensuring that we put the individual at the centre and recognise that we all have different needs and different circumstances. If we move to the next slide, I wanted to pick up from our foreword of the consultation document. We heard from the Minister, our colleagues on the task force, Becky, Alan and Colin. Here we've highlighted that approach around vulnerable people, ensuring their dignity and respect. And I think the video demonstrates that from the other members of the group that have contributed today. And ensuring that we're non-judgmental and we move to a national approach. And that's what the aim is of the standards, is to have consistent delivery and that no matter where you are in Scotland, you receive a high quality service. And then we're asked to really reflect, how would we like to receive services if it was us or a loved one who was needing to access treatment and support? And the next slide is our foreword from the Chief Medical Officer, the Chief Nursing Officer and the Chief Pharmaceutical Officer at the Scottish Government, that really just identifying this is one element of the task force work and one critical element in our ambitions to prevent drug deaths. I believe we can prevent them. I believe these standards are part of that process. And there has been a focus around opioid dependence. And we still know that many of our drug-related deaths have opiates and opioids implicated in them. So the next slide is really just to demonstrate why this work, why is it important, why are we doing it, to bring us back to the evidence. A lot of this will be familiar to many of you, and it's really informed our approach around the standards. This was an evidence review that I conducted in 2017 to inform rights, respect and recovery. And it also draws on the outcomes framework from 2014. Along the top, within treatment, care and support, these are the elements that we know people may present with. So thinking about the psychological and social barriers before even coming to treatments. The first 4 weeks in and out of treatment are critical intervention points. We know that there's an increased risk of deaths, and so it's important to provide intensive support at those times. And throughout the treatment and care that we provide, ensuring that we meet the complex physical and mental health needs of individuals. We know that many people may have had prolonged chronic drug use histories and will have a very complex and multiple physical and mental health needs. And the standards aim to reflect those. Along the bottom, it's the elements from the evidence that we know are effective, things we can do, things we know that will work. Ensuring a choice of medication, which we've heard so far this morning a lot, and thinking about how that can be an informed choice because different medications will work differently for different people. Reflecting on the therapeutic relationship, we just heard from Sylvia the difference her key worker made in terms of being confident that her treatment plan would not be changed and that it would be what she needed at that time. And broader psychosocial interventions are really will motivate and prevent dropout from the evidence. That's what we know, that the broader needs along with the medication are just as important in terms of improving people's quality of life. So this is just, as I say, to remind us of the evidence that we know that being in treatment is protective against the risk of death. Those in treatment have a reduced risk of less than a third compared to those out of treatment. And that was high level evidence, good quality findings around methadone and buprenorphine, and just recognising the intensive support that we hope the MAT standards will present. If I can hand over to Duncan now, we're going to walk you through the actual 10 standards. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Eleanor. So as Eleanor says, we know what works, it's clear, and it's well evidenced. What we need to do now is implement it. And there are places, many places in Scotland, which are doing a lot of great work, which we just heard from our colleagues in the video. But what is required to make a difference is consistency and a sustained response across all ADPs. And that's why the task force and why the Scottish Director of Public Health asked us to define standards for MAT and to work with ADPs to implement them. So here are the standards, the first five. The aim of these 10 standards is to get more people safely onto MAT for as long as they need. The first five standards we've heard a lot more about today, and that's because these really rely on drug services to take action. So it's a little bit faster, a little bit easier to make progress. The main things are, firstly, there needs to be no barriers to access medication-assisted treatment or MAT. And that means on some occasions, people may well start on the same day if that is what they need and if it's suitable to do so. People should be able to choose what drugs they take, what medication they take as part of MAT. And it might be methadone, it might be bufidal, which you heard about just now. It could be other things. And that choice needs to be informed. People need support to remain on treatment. And that's particularly the case in the first 4 weeks after starting MAT and the 4 weeks after finishing MAT. But also in between, things happen in people's lives. There's issues with housing, with welfare, the odd pandemic comes along. So we need to plan for these, and drug services really need to anticipate the care needs of the people they're working with so that people at high risk of non-fatal overdose and fatal overdose have care plans in place so that we can proactively prevent any issues. Harm reduction is a crucial thing, I think. Anyone who turns up for medication-assisted treatment may still be injecting drugs. And there has to be access to clean needles, syringes, and so on. There has to be access at point of delivery to testing for hepatitis C and HIV. There needs to be access to wound care and other harm reduction measures, again, with no barriers in place, no referrals to other places. It's up to people to choose what kind of MAT experience they have. And it's really up to the practitioners to make sure they have easy access to it, that it's safe, and it can support people for as long as they need. Standard 6 to 10, these really rely on complex systems to take effect. So they're going to take longer. And actually in the consultation, you'll find that we're much less developed with these for that very same reason. Here, I want to go back to the foreword. one of the comments from in the foreword was, how would you wish to be treated if you attended a match service? And I think we all want to be treated with kindness, with compassion. We want to be understood. We want to be treated well. And so it's absolutely vital that all services are trauma and psychologically informed, that the staff working in these services are trained and supported to deliver services which meet that criteria. Many people have underlying health conditions, and that is one of the many reasons why shared care with primary care is a really important component of this care package. Many people have lack of good housing, lack of welfare, income, support, advocacy. Again, there should be no barriers to people accessing that kind of support when they attend for or engage with MAP services. Mental health issues, in my experience and the experience of people I've worked with, seems to be one of the most common gaps identified with people experiencing problematic drug use and people providing services. And I think, again, it's absolutely crucial that people attending MAP services have no barriers to access that kind of support as part of the service at the point of care. So that's the standards. It's a work in progress. I need to make that clear. This means that we're working with ADPs to implement these standards, and at the same time, we are consulting on their implementation with as many people who can help us. This is because we can't wait. We need to take action now to prevent drug-related deaths.
You just heard Dr. Duncan McCormick, chair of the Drug Death Task Force MAT subgroup, and Eleanor Dickey, the organizational lead for Public Health Scotland. They were working on a webinar introducing a new set of standards for medication-assisted treatment in Scotland, which were developed in response to that nation's drug-related deaths public health emergency. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. Let's hear now from one of the other speakers on that webinar. Tracy Klusker is a nurse and a team manager with NHS Lothian based in Dalkeith, Scotland, where she's focused on reducing health inequalities while delivering a high-quality service to the recovery community.
Here to talk about, following on from Duncan and Eleanor, the work that I've been undertaking on behalf of the Scottish Drugs Task Force to look at the implementation of the MAT standards. And I want to give you some examples of innovation that I've certainly supported and how we want to take the work forward. So why is it important? So with as little as possibly 60% of people in treatment for drug use in Scotland, I think we have to ask ourselves, as service providers across Scotland, why this is. You know, what are we failing to do? Should we consider that it's not that the people that we are trying to engage are hard to engage, but that actually that some of the services that we're providing are hard for people to engage with? And in terms of moving forward, it's a priority of the task force, looking at how we adapt services and our workforce to engage people in service and improve that access to services from around 42% of people engaged into much higher numbers. We know that MAT is protective against drug-related death, so we have to look at how we adapt using the MAT standards as a framework. And what I want to do now is go on and talk about some projects that I've been involved with and supported that have managed to do some innovation around increasing the numbers with a very different style of working with people. So one of the projects that I was involved in, I started 6 months ago in Mid Lothian. This was following the release of the drug-related death figures in Scotland in 2018. And I guess I wanted to understand why, you know, again, so little people were in treatment in the area of the service that I was managing. So I sought out support and was very lucky to shadow Danny Ahmed from Middlesbrough. And so they had a tried and tested model whereby they were starting people on OST on the day of presentation. And really, I wanted this standard of care for the people that I was supporting in Mid Lothian. So the project that I'd undertaken was a quality improvement project, and it was based on the ethos of realistic medicine, which is really the spirit of the MAT standards, where the person is at the centre of all the care planning and all the decision making around them. So the initial aim was to start understand, as I say, why people are not in treatment and how would I increase these numbers. So the very first starting point for me, the top of this poster was to actually ask the people who use services or who have used services, ask them what were the barriers, what were putting people off coming into treatment, what did they find difficult about navigating treatment. Some of the feedback that I received was in terms of fixed appointments that were really difficult to attend, lengthy traumatising assessments whilst they were not instructed treatment, and multiple appointments with multiple people. So the first change that I done was to bring in point of care testing. So when people were arriving looking for OST, or we were seeking people out in the initial, for this project, people were looking for OST. We had almost turned the assessment process upside down. So instead of at one point in Lothian, I think assessment was over 30 pages long, we changed that to just an assessment that made that safe for us to prescribe for that person on that day. Now, that doesn't mean that we didn't take into account all the other needs, but this holistic assessment could be carried out over a period of time, and also given the person choice about who they would want to do that assessment with, who they wanted to share their information with. So the follow-up could be one-to-one nursing, a drop-in style, peer volunteer, smart recovery, and some people really engaged with mutual aid. What I do have to say within the thing that made this such a success in Midlothian was the peer volunteers who really did help and take people along to appointments or take them along to other wraparound care. The outcomes of the assessment is we did change our clinical governance. So it's really important if you're looking at doing an innovation project that you do have clinical governance that keeps the person safe and keeps the prescriber safe. But what we managed to do is reduce our assessment time from 3 appointments to 1. The feedback from people using the service was that the process was less traumatising. From the first cohort that we did involve in this particular test of change, 70% had a previous near-fatal overdose. From that, only one person continued to have further overdoses, but they did remain in treatment throughout and they were followed up, everyone accepting the naloxone BBV testing, and it was family inclusive. Only one person couldn't be started because they weren't clearly dependent, but subsequently were started. And that gives some assurances that the assessment process was working. And we did manage, if you look at the run chart at the bottom, to reduce our waiting times from 21 days to 0 for people starting OST. And you can see from the run chart, there's a huge peak. And that was someone who'd waited 100 days prior to the test of change, who had attended the needle exchange and was clearly using heroin in a very risky way, but it did take us 100 days to follow him up because we were unable to offer him OST at that time due to our governance processes on the day that he presented. And conclusion of this particular project that I worked in, there was no adverse events. 12 months later, all these patients are still doing well. We have not had anyone fall out of treatment. One person moved out of area. Some people opted for referral to trauma. We have someone in employment, and I think it was around 5 who went into residential rehab. The service has seen a 60% increase in referrals from the same time the previous year, so that gives some new evidence that low barrier access does make a difference to people accessing services. One of the learning points was that actually if you're working with people who have near fatal overdoses, the initial model that we had wanted for this particular innovation was really around people still coming into a clinic. And actually what we really needed to do was adapt this further and go to where people are, which we are still in Midlothian, are still currently again reassessing during COVID times and putting different models of care in place to accommodate that. So I just want to go on now and talk about another project that really demonstrates assertive outreach at its very best. And it was a very exciting project undertaken in response to COVID by Lynn Drysdale, a nurse in Edinburgh Access Practice. Now, she was very aware when the first lockdown came out around in March that there were people who were street begging in Edinburgh who were not in treatment, and their money supply in terms of access and drugs had been cut. Due to that they weren't allowed to do so due to lockdown and social distancing, and actually a lot of services had closed their doors. So there was a real reduction in people accessing service at a really high need time. So Lynn had looked remotely at how she could do this, and what she'd done in terms of her test of change, she switched to point of care testing and remote access to, and she actually went out and she went out to graveyards, she went round all the streets and she worked with people where they were at, with follow-up taking place in the Salvation Army, which was a safe place that many people would attend for various other reasons. Her test of change, she offered BBV testing, IEP, naloxone and referral on to other services, including BBV treatment. Lynn managed to bring treatment down from 7 days to commence and a prescription on the same day. Now, Lynn, throughout her entire test of change, really talks about the prescription being the start of a treatment process for people. And I would really urge you to go onto the Task Force website and read Lynn's blog. She gives a really clear understanding about how trauma-informed care needs to be provided throughout every aspect of service delivery, from the first point of meeting someone up to transition and their care onto someone else. So what can you do as a service provider? So, you know, I would imagine on the webinar today, there's many people who work in treatment services across Scotland. And it's really thinking about your own service and how this fits in. You know, do you have one door to access for people, or is there no wrong door? And a real starting point for myself, and I think for Lynn and the other projects that we've been involved in, is really thinking about your own service and mapping that out. You know, if you think many services, in case people have to call the service, then a letter sent out, and then, you know, it's two or three appointments, which was the case in Midlothian, before someone can be assessed and they'll get a receive an appointment for a prescriber who may be a different person from the, you know, the other people that have seen people for triage, for thorough assessment. If someone doesn't turn up, what's the protocol? Do you discharge them? Do you see that as poor engagement, as opposed to the services aren't actually managing to engage people? And I think then it's mapping that as the person who's trying to access the service. If you see it through their lens, do you know when is it, if it's a telephone call to refer yourself, if someone doesn't have phone, if they don't have credit, do you know if they don't have an address for a letter to be sent to? Many people will have adverse events in their lives to find relationship building very difficult. So if it's a long assessment and they have to see several people before they start a prescription, that can be very, very difficult. They feel they often have to tell their story to many people. One family member talked about taking their loved one for a prescription, being told to go, you know, with and support them with a drug diary and come back in 2 weeks. And that was absolutely horrific because they were trying everything to keep their loved one alive. And really, a drug diary or this response didn't feel that this was helping save that person's life for them. So it's considering the impact of what your services have and how people access them. And if you just look at all the barriers and what that feels like for the person using the service and how you can reduce them. And if people are working with mental health, justice systems, if they are seeing their person, can you have seamless pathways so it's not another referral, not another assessment for someone to start on OST? Next slide, please. So I will just finish up just giving an oversight of the current work. If you've heard about some of the innovation, there are many more projects, and these will be live on the Task Force website. Now, this is just the projects just now that the Task Force are supporting in a QI methodology way, and many people across Scotland are now starting to look at different ways of working with people using project charters. We're also looking at a community of practice to learn from each other around some of the near fatal overdose initiatives, how we can share and diffuse that innovation across Scotland. We're also really keen to hear from any service providers who have existing successful practice so we can map again, share that knowledge and link people up so they can learn from that for their own area. We're very, very keen to hear from anyone across Scotland who would want to be part of a MAT test of change site, and we would support that through QI methodology. And I'm very aware that a lot of the information I've discussed today refers mainly to the use of OST as a starting point for MAT. However, we would like the consideration, we are going to be looking at an expert or steering group around benzodiazepines and the impact that it's having on people accessing services and the impact it's having on drug-related harm and death. And we also will be are engaging in terms of the overall standards, as I said, with other agencies to look at, working with LPASNES, the Royal College of GPs and advocacy projects to ensure that we have input from all the other experts to ensure that holistic care is provided through every aspect of a person's treatment.
That was Tracy Klusker. She's a nurse and team manager with NHS Lothian and spoke in the webinar introducing a new set of standards for medication-assisted treatment in Scotland, which were developed in response to that nation's drug-related deaths public health emergency. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. The Council on Criminal Justice recently held a webinar on the impact of the 2020 elections on the criminal justice system. Let's hear a bit from that. Tara Simmons is a state representative-elect in Washington State. She works as a Scotton Fellow at the Public Defenders Association in Seattle, Washington, where her focus area is on expanding the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Project and providing lead legal services.
Yeah, you know, one of the opportunities that I've had is that I was released from prison 7 years ago, and I was able to go to law school. And when I graduated from law school, the Washington State Bar Association originally denied my application to become an attorney to sit for the bar exam because of my past. So one of the things I had really going for me is that I had appealed that decision to the state Supreme Court, and I won in a unanimous same-day decision. And in that opinion, the Supreme Court wrote, your past does not define your future, right? And it was a beautiful opinion. And I was able to use that because, you know, while I got support from both sides, Democrats and Republicans, who really resonated with my story of recovery and second chances and redemption, there was people on both sides who also used it against me and, you know, did horrible smear campaigns and sent out my court records. But what I had in my hand was a Supreme Court decision where they had reviewed 1,300 pages of my entire life story and ruled unanimously that your past does not define your future, and allowed me to become a lawyer. And so I will say it was a mixed bag, and it's not a partisan issue. I really believe strongly that there are people from both sides who really resonate and have educated themselves and understand how if we keep people locked in cages for 60 years with no chance for reentry and no chance for parole, how that actually harms future recidivism rates, and they're not prioritizing rehabilitation in prison. Right. And there are some people who, you know, really believe that once you commit a crime, you cannot come back. And so I love that we're having this discussion because it is an area where we can come together and educate ourselves and get rooted in research and data and create policy that really does keep us all safe. And so that's how it played out in my campaign and the work that I'm committed to doing and leading in Washington State now.
That was Tara Simmons, a state representative-elect in Washington State. She was speaking on a webinar sponsored by the Council on Criminal Justice that looked at the impact of the 2020 elections on criminal justice. And that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. The executive producer of the Drug Truth Network is Dean Becker. Be sure to check out Dean's video project, Claiming the Moral High Ground. Find links at drugtruth.net or search for Becker's Buds and Claiming the Moral High Ground on YouTube. The Drug Truth Network programs are available by podcast. URLs to subscribe are also on the network homepage at drugtruth.net. The Drug Truth Network has a Facebook page. Please give it a like. Drug War Facts is on Facebook, too. Give its page a like and share it with friends. Remember, knowledge is power. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh, and of course also at Drug Policy Facts. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.